All right, once again, we are welcoming your questions on Slido, or you may come up to the microphone. If you come to the microphone, please introduce yourself before your question. But before we go to questions, I'd like to turn to my panelists and see if they, in turn, have a question for their fellow panelists.
Well, perhaps a bit of a response to Jesse's interesting comments. Jesse, you sent... Now, okay, I'll hold it closer to myself. Thank you. So Jesse distinguished sensibly between originalism as theory and originalism as practiced. And I guess my first response to that would be, as practiced since when? It's only since late 2020 that we've had arguably an originalist majority on the Supreme Court. So it's difficult, I think, to fault originalism for the failures that existed when you did not have a majority of originalist justices. Jesse raises the very interesting question of stare decisis, adherence to precedent, what sort of further rulings might the court overturn? And he highlights the excessive weight that's given to the non-discrimination norm and to diversity. Of course, those values are actually in conflict, non-discrimination and diversity. In the pending cases in the Supreme Court and challenging race preferences from Harvard and UNC, so you might well see a very good ruling there. More broadly, though, you know, there's a fair question, what should originalism aim to overrule? What should the agenda be? And I think in many ways we have come to accept, say, incorporation, the notion that the Bill of Rights applies against the states as it does against the federal government. Some originalists argue that this is right as a matter of principle. Others simply accept it as it seems too late to change. I think that while I entirely agree with you that the Establishment Clause, it makes no sense to have that apply against the states, I think in perhaps every state in the nation, maybe there's some exceptions, we accept that as a foundational rule now, and it's difficult to see how changing that rule would actually affect anything. It's interesting to look at the ruling in Engel v. Vitale in 1962, the school prayer case. Now, stay in your seats here while I read to you the prayer that was to be said at the opening of a school day in New York State every day, and that the court found to be an unconstitutional establishment of religion. Here it is in its terrible detail. Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon thee, and we beg thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. That's it. That's what the Supreme Court found to be an unconstitutional establishment of religion. But let's say that, how many people in this room want the school teachers of today to be leading students in whatever prayer, in the prayers that the local school boards would approve of? I think in many parts of the country, it'd be a very scary prospect.
Can you hear me? All right. So some really good points. On the first point, I do think it's fair to point out the failures of originalism even before you have a majority of the court, because what you could do is you could look at what various judges and justices are using originalism for over time. So even though we now have more originalists on the court, even though originalism has certainly been ascendant as a mode of interpretation, the version of originalism that has ascended is much more diluted and much less, I would say, conservative in its ideological orientation. So if you compare, for example, the originalism of Judge Robert Bork, Professor Raoul Berger, Antonin Scalia himself, So these are the leading originalists of the 1970s and 80s. If you compare those figures to the originalism of today, those figures were much more conservative in terms of how they viewed originalism than our originalists today. So the majority doesn't tell you very much. And sure, there's the Dobbs decision, and you could argue about whether or not it's actually an originalist decision. But of course, it took 50 years, and the big question then is what happens next? So obviously, it'd be premature to say, well, that's it. Originalism isn't going to do anything else. But I don't think it's premature to point out that originalism has changed, and it's changed in a way that has weakened it. And I do see that as a major problem. The fact that Jackson, Kagan, and Sotomayor can invoke originalism is not a strength. What that means is that it's become so weak and diluted that it can be appropriated so that we're not having serious engagement on the issues that are dividing us as a constitutional matter. In terms of disincorporation, yeah, that's exactly the point. How do you restore the order once you've lost it? And, you know, it's easy to see how we got to where we are today, right? If you just follow the trajectory of the Warren Court between 1954 and 1968, they systematically changed our constitutional order through various decisions. Once we no longer are accustomed to thinking of ourselves as being citizens of a state, being part of communities, having intact families, I don't know how to restore that. And Engel, obviously, you know, New York is going to, if it were given the authority to write a prayer, who knows what it would look like in 2023 as opposed to in 1963. But perhaps a more important case than Engel is the Shemp case coming out of Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania wasn't writing a prayer. I mean, I have a problem actually with the fact that New York was writing a prayer. So even though I don't favor the incorporation of the Establishment Clause, I think it's pretty weird for New York as a political entity to be drafting a prayer. What Pennsylvania was doing, what the Abington County School Board was doing, was merely reciting the Lord's Prayer, which is a fundamental feature of how education had operated in this country since the creation of common schools in the 1830s. That practice, I think, should be able to flourish. And that's not something that requires the state of Pennsylvania to be involved in. It just means that some counties, and there certainly would be lots of counties in central Pennsylvania, that would be interested in restoring it. So, but I have no illusions about the Supreme Court going down this road. I don't think that the Supreme Court has the stomach, and I don't think we as a people have the stomach, to go down the road of disincorporating the Establishment Clause and having some communities actually lead the day with the Lord's Prayer. Because we are committed to anti-discrimination, and we're committed to inclusion. And of course, there are going to be some children who are not Christian. And the American people are just not comfortable with the idea that there will be people who are excluded from that exercise. I take that to be the central problem confronting originalists and conservatives today.
All right, we continue to get thumbs up for the number one question, which was kind of touched on here, but I'll let Ed, you take the first crack, and Jesse, if you'd like to, which is, what are your thoughts on originalism's failure to effectively combat gender/woke ideology in legal interpretation? An example would be Bostock versus Clayton County.
Well, I think that Bostock was wrongly decided. As many of you know, that was an opinion written by Justice Gorsuch for a 6-justice majority. The originalists on the court divided 3-1 against Gorsuch. Gorsuch was the only one there. I think it was his opinion is an exercise in bad originalism. I don't think it's, I will quibble with the phrasing of the question. I don't think it's the role of originalism to combat woke ideology. It's the role of originalism to construe statutes properly, and in this case, that would have, should have delivered a defeat for woke ideology.
One comment on the Bostock question. I mean, I think it's interesting, all the conversation surrounding Bostock in the legal community, the people that Ed and I follow and engage with, was on whether this was textualism. So there's a distinction between textualism in the statutory context and originalism in the constitutional context, but they're pretty much the same mode of interpretation. but whether textualism was practiced properly. So the people who are critical of textualism, you know, condemned textualism, said, look, this is what it produces. And the defenders explained that this was textualism done improperly. I think the more interesting question than that, you know, is this good or bad textualism, is what actually produced the opinion culturally. I am almost certain that Neil Gorsuch would not have written that opinion if it was 2013, meaning before Obergefell, as opposed to 2023. That was 2022. But the point is that if he had that question, even though it involved the language from the 64 Act, just 10 years earlier, I think it's very unlikely he would have reached the same outcome. And I think that shows the power of culture, and that's what legal conservatives need to be addressing. Not just textualism as such, but the culture that I think is driving how textualism and originalism operate.
All right, please introduce yourself and your question.
Sure, thank you so much. Lee Strang from the University of Toledo, and I appreciate the nuanced and thoughtful conversation you all have had today. My question is for my good friend, Jesse. And so, Jesse, I appreciated the portrait that you painted of originalism, and I wanted to see whether the portrait was maybe unnecessarily negative because of a premise that was unarticulated that foreclosed some other positive aspects of originalism. So in your recounting of originalism and its failures, you listed a number of substantive provisions, the Interstate Commerce Clause, incorporation, et cetera. Now, I actually disagree with you on the substance of those points, but putting those aside, there's a long tradition in the West, in the Anglo-American world, of identifying the rule of law with pre-existing law that then is applied through independent legal organs like judges. And originalism is committed to the propositions of the rule of law. So I'm wondering if what the audience is missing is a process side in which originalism is valuable. So we see all around the world the rule of law breaking down, especially in pluralistic countries like our own, and originalism is committed precisely to the propositions of the rule of law, and that seems very valuable. So I wanted to see what your thoughts were.
Yeah, thanks for that, Lee. I don't know if originalism, the way that we practice it, is required for the rule of law. I think that the rule of law has flourished in many countries. And you know, when Aristotle writes about the rule of law, he's not talking about originalism. I don't think you need a constitutional text to have the rule of law. I think maybe in our country we do need originalism to have the rule of law, but I don't take them to be the same thing. And I'm also a little less optimistic about the rule of law flourishing in this country. Recent events involving how the law has been enforced, particularly within the state of New York, there is an indictment that I think questions whether the rule of law is really flourishing. There was a conviction of someone yesterday, for a satirical tweet under an 1870 Reconstruction law. I don't see those as examples of the rule of law working, and I see originalism as really outside of that question. In a way, it's epiphenomenal. It's just not necessarily corresponding with the rule of law developing in the West.
We'll take the next one here.
Yeah, thank you so much. My question, I think, is more fundamental, and I want to get to the root of what I see as the problem. Is there any future for originalism and the Constitution itself when we essentially do not follow the document on major public policy decisions? And I'll give two examples. It seems very likely that the United States military blew up the Nord Stream pipeline, thereby intervening in the Ukraine conflict without a constitutionally mandated declaration of war. And also during COVID, states took away the right to assembly, speech, and worship without any due process of law, and virtually no court was willing to intervene. In light of these two major policy decisions made outside of the constitutional order, again, what is the future of having a constitutional order simply?
I mean, I wouldn't just look at COVID and the Ukraine as illustrations of that. The fact that we haven't had a Congress declare war in over 75 years at this point, I think is just as serious a problem as any of the issues that originalists discuss. I take that to be a really at the core of how we no longer are bound by the rule of law.
Go ahead, Joe.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Joe Morris, a humble common lawyer from the state of Illinois. Mr. Whalen used the useful phrase, the conservative legal project, and Mr. Merriam, you have in many ways for us identified the nature of the leftist legal project. It is a radical attempt to assert what you call the civil rights philosophy across the board. One might call that radical egalitarianism and radical statism, and that leftist legal project goes all the way back 100 years or more, maybe to Woodrow Wilson's years. If we understand originalism and textualism as a tool, as Mr. Whalen, I think, correctly argues, to take away the business of judgecraft in interpreting constitutions and statutes and contracts and other written texts as constraining judges so they cannot insert their leftist activist values in that area, then we've accomplished a lot. You've identified a lot of things that seem to require legislative action in legislatures or pulpits or classrooms or the culture and so forth. I would like to ask you a question, both of you, that focuses on what may in fact be done to advance the conservative legal project, something that judges can do. And that involves judges who don't just do the work of interpreting statutes and constitutions and texts. That's what federal judges do. Federal judges only do constitutions, statutes, and texts. State court judges, and we've got one Supreme Court justice from one of our 50 states in this room right now, are indeed constitution construers and statute construers and contract construers, but they're also the makers and founts of common law. Common law is judge-made law, the law of contracts, the law of torts, the law of property. Ought we not make it a key part of the conservative legal project going forward to reclaim the common law from what the left has done to it over the last 100 years and more, the predations of Oliver Wendell Holmes, of Roscoe Pound and others? A serious conservative effort was made to do that in the law and economics movement of people like Richard Posner and so forth. But can we not do better than law and economics? Is it not a way to reclaim the common law and make it an engine of the revival of the traditional principles that undergirded the law of the Anglo-American world?
Well, my first thought on the question of state common law is that state legislation, of course, can supersede common law, and I would generally put more reliance on state legislatures to determine policy through statutes, rendering common law obsolete, than to trust judges to develop the common law in a way that's sensible, especially if it involves reversals of longstanding liberal practices.
I'll just say one thing on that. I agree, restoring state common law power would be a very healthy addition to our republic. And I would point out that two things have really hurt in that regard. Obviously, one is the notion of federal common law and the fact that states don't have the same authority that they have. Of course, the Swift v. Tyson was overruled, but there's still some federal common law that lurks. And the second is the decline of state constitutionalism. I mean, states have their own constitutions, and they're free to go above the federal floor. So when it comes to free speech, freedom of association, states are free to do that. But state judges, I think, have become quite timid. And that's partly a result of state judges being educated in nationally oriented law schools and losing their attention and focus on their own state constitutional traditions, which have largely been lost over time.
But the more many of these state court justices begin to focus on their state constitutions, the more they're going to see those constitutions as empowering them to do all sorts of bad things. So I of course agree with you that in theory these state constitutions could provide greater liberties, and in some cases they perhaps actually do. But as we see with all the abortion litigation, for example, going on around the country in the aftermath of Dobbs, this is, I think, much more a license for liberal state Supreme Court justices to run amok.
Let's return to Slido here. A popular question is your opinion of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Is it acting as a second constitution?
Is that for me? Either one of you right. want to take that hot potato.
You know, this is Christopher Caldwell's point. I assume that the question is alluding to Christopher Caldwell's book, and I think it's an excellent book. And obviously, this is the subject that people don't want to touch. At the center of Bork's confirmation hearing was this subject, because he had written a New Republic essay criticizing the act when it was still in Congress. And, you know, that's a big part of why he was not confirmed. It was obviously partly about substantive due process and abortion and originalism, but a big part of it was also civil rights, and you guys are, I'm sure, aware of how Senator Biden attacked Bork on those grounds. I think that Caldwell makes a very good point about the 64 Act, and it's not just in terms of what it does legally as a technical matter to public accommodations, to private schools, and to employment, but also what it represents culturally. I don't think it's a coincidence that the very next year you get the 65 Immigration Act, and that's because of the flourishing of anti-discrimination as becoming our greatest good and diversity becoming our greatest strength. And I think that these are essentially the moral axes around which our entire system currently revolves.
Well, let's have in mind that there are two very different aspects of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. One, the one that Jesse has focused on, is the extension of these prohibitions into the private realm, and that's undoubtedly had tremendous consequences, and I agree with you. So many folks seem to, young people especially, seem to think that non-discrimination is the highest value. But let's have in mind also that the same act prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, and therefore, if applied according to its text, would forbid the racial preferences that are operating throughout our society. And you've had, you know, one bad Supreme Court after a ruling after another saying the law doesn't mean what it says. But I think there is some hope that its plain meaning will be restored.
I'm Attorney Bill Bonner. My question is, do you believe that the amendments found on page 950 of the current Military Appropriations Act, which transfer jurisdiction over the definition of a pandemic in America, and the response that should be effected by the United States government, create a significant crack in the foundations of our sovereignty, our originalism, and our whole rule of law?
I think we're both unfamiliar with the area, so I'm sorry that we can't provide a response.
All right, let's go back to Slido. What's the best answer for the definition of religion in the Constitution, and what are the implications of that definition for religious freedom?
So the Supreme Court has treated religion, I imagine this matters, that the question is getting at the Free Exercise Clause as opposed to the Establishment Clause. So there are two provisions at reference in the religion clauses. One is the Free Exercise Clause, which prohibits Congress from prohibiting the free exercise of religion. That's the religious liberty provision. The other is the Establishment Clause, which says that Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion, and that has been interpreted, of course, to create what the court said in 1947, a separation of church and state. So we have one dealing with church-state relations and the other dealing with religious liberty. The Supreme Court, in the religious liberty context, that's where it matters more, has interpreted religion to be a belief in the supernatural. And that could include, there's the famous conscription cases, it could include someone who is committed to not harming another person because of his commitment to, you know, the theology or metaphysics of, like, Spinoza's ethics. So even that sort of view of the supernatural and the nature of metaphysics would constitute a religion. Is that the proper interpretation of religion? Yeah, I don't know that it really matters for purposes of free exercise law, most of the free exercise law has to do with traditional religions, at least now. So a lot of the cases from the 1980s dealt with Native American practices, but I think that they looked very much like religions. But a lot of the disputes now actually have to do with conservative Christians. So if you look at the most recent cases, like the Masterpiece case, the 303 case, the Fulton case, we're talking about Catholics and Protestants. There's a real transition in terms of religious liberty law. It's interesting in itself. If you look at the emergence of free exercise law in 1963, to 1990, that's the Smith decision, the vast majority have to do with non-traditional religions, or at least non-Christian faiths. There are very few cases involving Christians. The big exception is the Bob Jones case. But now, almost all of the cases that get to the Supreme Court, and I think even the majority in the federal judiciary as a whole, involve not just Christians, but conservative Christians.
I don't know that the Supreme Court has ever defined in a very satisfactory way what constitutes a religion for purposes of the religion clauses. There's a somewhat circular definition in a case called Wisconsin v. Yoder. To have the protection of the religion clauses, the claims must be rooted in religious belief. And then there's an explanation of what religious belief is that, is, again, it's not entirely clear what the bounds are. I will highlight that the more that there's pressure to expand the protections of the free exercise clause to quasi-philosophical beliefs, the more you end up with this real tension with the Establishment Clause, where you know, public schools, for example, impose secularism as the reigning ideology? If a secular belief suffices to count as religious for purposes of the free exercise clause, you think it would create problems under the Establishment Clause?
I'm curious what the panelists would think would be some constitutional amendments that, all other things being equal, the conservative legal movement should at least articulate. I know, all other things being equal, at least some that they'd put down on paper and say, these are things we should push for.
A very interesting question. I think it's fair to say that one flaw in the Constitution is how difficult it is to amend it. And those who excuse exercises in liberal judicial activism would say that, the difficulty of the amendment process made us do it, that somehow there was this, you know, manifestly just result that had to be pursued, and the public wouldn't achieve that through the ordinary means. I like the idea of, I guess it's called Convention of the States. This is a process answer, not a substantive answer to your question. But so far, stepping back a bit, and I should have the Constitution in front of me, so pardon me if I misspeak here. But the Article 5 sets forth two different means of proposing amendments for ratification. The first, the only one that's ever been used, is amendments proposed by Congress. And Congress can really be a huge bottleneck on this. The second is a convention of the states that would then propose amendments to be ratified by 3/4 of the states. Interestingly, decades ago, there were conservatives, I think Phyllis Schlafly was very vocal among them, who loudly protested against this convention of the states option, with concern about a runaway convention that might do all sorts of, you know, crazy things. Despite the fact that you still have this backstop of the 3/4 ratification threshold, I think it'd be very interesting to have a convention of the states and just see what sort of amendments folks would come up with. The last one that I think got any real traction fell short was a balanced budget amendment. I'm skeptical that that could really do anything. Look, I think there might be something to be said for actually addressing by amendment some of the contested areas in constitutional law, say the scope of Congress's powers under the Commerce Clause. You have further thoughts?
Too much to say. Obviously, one of the problems is that we don't have constitutional amendments anymore. Yeah, you get 10 right away in 1791, and then you get a few to or two to address deficiencies, and then you get three in response to the Civil War. And you know, since then, we haven't had major substantive changes. And that's partly because of expanding judicial review. There are certainly some in that time period between 16th and 17th Amendments are very important. I don't mean to downplay those. The past 75 years, I should say, we're not getting those sorts of constitutional moments, and that's partly because of the expansion of judicial power. Once judges can effectively change what the Constitution means through the exercise of judicial review, we lose the capacity as a people to think about what we actually want to change. And that's why that question is so challenging. We're just not in the habit of thinking what we'd want to change. Personally, I'd want to change the Constitution to mean what it actually says. So I have a hard time coming up with a proposal because I'd want to address things like, this is what the Commerce Clause means. The Commerce Clause does not mean there's a dormant Commerce Clause. That's not in the Constitution. The Supremacy Clause means that federal law preempts state law if and only if there's an actual conflict between federal and state law. That means that all those decisions creating this four-step preemption doctrine, all those decisions are wrong because they didn't involve actual conflicts. So I would want to just go through all those decisions, and you would be amazed how many you'd find. You'd be into the hundreds, I think, very quickly. So I'm less interested in particular amendments and more interested in getting the Constitution to do what it says.
Thank you. Annette.
I was a teacher in New York in the public schools in 1962 when the ruling came down that you could no longer say the prayer. That, by the way, was a regent's prayer, so it was composed by the regents of the state of New York. And so it was a state prayer in a sense. But at any rate, it came down, and I told the students in my class, it was a high school class, that they could no longer say the prayer. Well, they had said the Pledge of Allegiance and the prayer every day rather methodically. Well, suddenly when someone told them they couldn't say it, they became rebels. And so suddenly they all said the prayer, and they said it very loudly, and it became known that my class was still saying the prayer, and I was saying, no, no, you can't pray. And they kept saying, well, we're going to. They can't tell us we can't pray. So I then had to report to the principal that I didn't know what to do. The principal then had to come into the class and tell them and why they couldn't, and they were still pretty angry about it all. And then they started praying privately in their own. They say, well, they can't take that away from us. And so, I mean, these children were just normal kids that weren't particularly evangelical previously. But at any rate, one wonders now, if they could take that away, what do you think will happen with the under God in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I think that under God is secure with this court.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, even before, when it was brought before the Supreme Court invented this notion of standing that prevented Michael Newdow from bringing his case, because even that court didn't want to touch it. So I don't think that it's going anywhere. It's worth noting, though, that the reference to God was created in 1954. It's not a long-standing tradition. Not saying that I want to get rid of it, but like the New York prayer, it was something that was created at a particular time. It's not a fundamental feature of the American tradition, although you could argue that now it is, after 70 years of having it there.
You both spoke about a somewhat unclear definition of religion under the Constitution. Would originalists defend Satanism as a recognized religion if brought to the fore?
I am inclined to see no basis for rejecting Satanism as a religion. I don't think it's, insofar as it's a expects protection for child sacrifice. It's not going to get that. But I think the courts have found it very, very difficult to distinguish between, you know, real religions and phony religions. There is a sincerity test, and it's possible that some professed Satanists could be shown to be insincere in what they're saying. But, you know, much as I would despise Satanists, I'm not sure that the law is capable of distinguishing between valid religions and Satanism.
Two noteworthy cases are Lukumi, which dealt with Santeria. Now, Santeria is a mix of Voodooism and Christianity in the Caribbean. And then there's a case involving a Wiccan prison inmate who was extended protection under the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So in both of those cases, the Supreme Court had a very easy time finding that it was dealing with religion. So I think the same would apply to Satanism. Not saying that Voodooism or Wiccanism are satanic. I'm not exactly sure what they involve, but they're certainly not traditional religions. And notably, it may not extend to animal sacrifice, but human sacrifice, but it would extend to animal sacrifice, because that's what the Lukumi case was about.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm curious about the role in originalism in protecting or promoting this idea of constitutionalism, which after Federalist 49 was a relatively novel idea, the idea that constitutional law would be have some special reverence above ordinary laws. Does having a neutral way to interpret constitutional law allow us to provide this sort of reverence that seems to be somewhat valuable?
That's why I was saying that in a different country, in a different order, where you didn't need to get that reverence from the Constitution, I think that you would probably not need something like originalism. But in our system, I think that that's where our reverence for the law is going to come from, because we don't have the same traditions and shared norms and common heritage that a lot of other nations have. So I think that we would need something like originalism in order to have that. I think that's why it's flourished to the extent that it has in the United States. And I'd be very reluctant to give that up.
I think that there is a proper reverence, if that's not a sacrilegious word here, for the framers that is independent of originalism. That is, I think you can ask the question, what would the founders do on this or that policy question? That's not an originalist inquiry, because you're recognizing this is a policy question. And you know, the founders created this system of Republican self-government, understanding that it was dependent on a people of a certain virtue to sustain it, giving broad freedom for policies to be adopted in all sorts of different ways. But I think we can say, look, we see what has made, what at least used to make this country great. Let's look back to what the founders had to say. And, you know, foremost among them, I guess Washington wouldn't typically, well, not a framer, but certainly a founder. You know, you look at what he had to say in his farewell address about the role of religion in sustaining morality and the essential role of morality in sustaining this government. I'm going to just find the particular passage here, because I think it's, you know, something we should remind ourselves of regularly. Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports.
Cal, please state your name and affiliation.
Yes. Calvin Beisner with the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. I find it really interesting that these issues of how to define religion and how it is incorporated, rather, how it relates to constitutional interpretation and so on, have come back again and again. And I just want to ask both of you, in light of two other things that haven't been mentioned so far, if you might want to perhaps nuance a little bit what you've said so far. One of those things is that Justice Joseph Story, of course, one of the early Supreme Court Chief Justices and author of his commentaries on the Constitution, very explicitly wrote that in the First Amendment, as well as generally in the writings of the founders, religion meant Christianity. It did not mean Jainism or Hinduism or Islam or anything else. It meant Christianity. And that was the understanding that at least he, as one of that generation, would have put on it. And the other interesting question, and this is actually in tension with that, is that in Torcaso v. Watkins, the Supreme Court explicitly ruled that secular humanism is a religion under the Constitution's definition of religion, if the Constitution has a definition. All right, and that was in a case in which the American Humanist Society was appealing for recognition as a religion so that its counselors could be given ministerial exclusion from Social Security and various other issues. So it seems to me that both of those suggest that maybe we need to think a little differently from what we have so far. And frankly, I don't know just how differently.
Well, I have not studied the point you raised about Joseph's story, but I will say that it's, as I say, clear from George Washington's beautiful letter to the Jewish congregation in Newport, Rhode Island, that there was an understanding that of course, Jews were exercising their religion and ought to have the freedom to do so in this country. So I'm skeptical. I mean, it would have been very easy to craft the First Amendment to refer to free exercise of Christianity. It doesn't say that. The founders were aware of the existence of non-Christian religions at the time. So again, I haven't studied what Joseph Story had to say, but I'm skeptical that religion in the First Amendment should be construed to mean only Christianity. On your second point, yeah, I think that's again, if secular humanism is a religion for purposes of the Free Exercise Clause, why isn't it an establishment of religion to impose secular humanism, you know, in the schools and elsewhere?
And the first point, I believe the Story reference is not to the free exercise of religion, but to the establishment of religion. I think what Story was saying in the commentaries is that the United States could have an established form of Christianity that would not be an establishment of religion, because Christianity has a special place in the American tradition. So it couldn't have an established Catholic Church or an established Baptist Church, but there could be a preference for Christians over non-Christians without running afoul of the Establishment Clause. And that would not touch on the subject of whether Jews or Muslims or Hindus would have the right to worship as they please and to, you know, honor the Sabbath according to the dictates of their conscience, but it would mean that Christianity would have a special place in public education, in the government. It could be promoted. And this is something that I think that it's hard for us to come to terms with, right? So it used to be the case, and as late as 1892, the Supreme Court famously said, this is a Christian nation. It wasn't until really the 1950s, and I think it was Eisenhower who said, started using the term Judeo-Christian. Fast forward, you know, 60 or 50 years later, and you get the Ten Commandments cases, and all of a sudden we're talking about it being a monotheistic nation. Including not just Christians, but Jews and Muslims. And that goes to the point that I was making before, that originalism doesn't work the way that it really should be working, in my opinion, with all of the cultural changes. So the whole idea of it being a Christian nation, it turns into a monotheistic nation, not because the Establishment Clause is being understood differently, just because of the nature of the people. That has changed.
Clifford Humphrey, Troy University. Thank you for this conversation. It's fascinating. My question is regard to what does originalism have to say to the idea of what we might call societal harm? So if I think about blasphemy laws in an earlier period in history, which we now look at, I think, through a kind of classical liberal lens and say those aren't legitimate because the only real harms are sort of things like physical harm, material harm. But of course, that idea still remains in the idea of hate speech, for example. And I'm wondering, that all seems really vague and hard to understand, and is it legitimate? So what does originalism have to say about the concept of societal harm? Because I think it might bring clarity to this idea of, can we really have pluralism if there are certain things that we determine are harmful to society that harms one segment, maybe just the Christians? So what does originalism have to say about the concept of societal harm as a legitimate thing?
Thing that comes to mind in terms of societal harm is that Congress is not given the authority to regulate societal harms in Article 1, Section 8, right? Its broadest authority is the power to regulate commerce among the several states. That has nothing to do with societal harms, and that means that there's no federal police power. So I think that the most direct answer is that societal harm could certainly animate state legislative bodies, but it has no role in federal lawmaking.
From an originalist perspective, I think the question would be, what did the freedom of speech mean at the time that it was incorporated into the First Amendment? And did that allow blasphemy laws? I don't know the answer to that question. Perhaps you've looked at it. Hate speech laws, I have to say, are incredibly dangerous. Hate speech is undefinable. Hate speech is speech that someone hates. There are all sorts of people who are incentivized to play victim. Well, once you legitimate that category, I doubt very much that beyond the possible realm of blasphemy, there would be any basis for a ban on hate speech.
If I may just, Jesse, what about an originalist understanding of state constitutions, right? So not a federal one, but there is precedent for enforcing blasphemy laws in state constitutions, and you probably know the cases better than I. So I still want to press on that. It seems like, though, there is something from the founding that would help inform how states could regulate offensive speech or print material even.
So certainly, blasphemy laws were around. I don't know of any interpretations of state constitutions dealing with blasphemy laws, but the blasphemy laws were upheld. They weren't considered a violation of free speech, free exercise, or the establishment of religion. Could this be interpreted as satisfying the free speech clause? Certainly. I think pornography is something that states should be able to regulate. And I think that the Supreme Court's decisions from the 1960s, like the Miller and Roth decisions, are wrong. Not only were they wrongly decided, I think they're wrong as a moral matter, and they've created what I consider to be a national tragedy. The amount of pornography that comes out of the United States is, I think, a very serious matter. So I would certainly want states to think about regulating things like that, but again, that would be something left to the states in terms of exercising their police powers.
Great example, I think, for showing the importance of this question, so thank you.
Hi there, Joshua Wechter from Hillsdale College. My question is to Mr. Whalen specifically, although Dr. Miriam can jump in as well, because Mr. Whalen discussed the victory of originalism insofar as it's led to originalist majority on the Supreme Court, large amounts of originalist judges being appointed in the federal courts. And yet, to go back to a couple things that were touched on earlier, an originalist majority on the Supreme Court failed to prevent this country from being turned into a giant concentration camp during the COVID lockdowns for a considerable amount of time after. Even after Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed. As was mentioned earlier, one of the originalist justices on ostensibly originalist grounds, though I understand there are qualms about that, voted to make trans rights part of Supreme Court precedent, handing the biggest victory to trans ideology that it's been able to win. There's, of course, the issue of voting law election law cases in the states and a lot of questions concerning that during the last presidential election that haven't been addressed by the court. So I guess put simply, the question is, what is the use of this originalist these majorities that have been created when it seems that on every front, in terms of the security of our elections, our basic civil and natural rights, and in the terms of the culture, that originalist majority has failed to stem the tide?
Well, I have a lot of disagreement with the question. I mean, first of all, I just have to say I think a term like giant concentration camps is just absurd. One can object to policies one place after another, but I think it's just a ridiculous characterization of what occurred. Maybe I was just lucky to somehow have escaped that giant concentration camp. More broadly, look, we do not live in a government in which the courts are going to provide the answer to everything. You have opportunities to contact your legislators. You can file lawsuits, but you're not going to expect that the court is going to provide a quick remedy for everything. Get used to it. The Supreme Court is supreme over other courts. It's not the supreme organ of government, and we shouldn't treat it as such. So I think the premise of your question elevates the Supreme Court to a position it shouldn't have. And I would encourage you to be fighting through your state legislators, through your members of Congress, to get the policies that you need, that you want. Sometimes you're going to lose out. Our system is not one in which you can expect every question to be decided by the Supreme Court, much less to be decided in very quick order under exceptionally fraught circumstances.
Jesse, any final thoughts on that question? All right. We just have time for one more very quick question, and I'm going to grab one that's very different from the others here on Slido. Colin Gagne has come up with one here. Robert Bork frequently referred to the justices of the Supreme Court as Olympians. Are we governed by Olympians? Does the Supreme Court hold too much power?
Answer that question.
Yeah,
I think we agree. I think maybe where we disagree, we both presumably agree with Marbury v. Madison and the power of judicial review, is when the scope of that jurisdiction turns into the U.S. Supreme Court overseeing all of our major social controversies and having that authority over the states through incorporation. That's when the judicial review and the relatively humble power that's asserted by Chief Justice Marshall in 1803 turns into judicial supremacy in Cooper v. Aaron by Chief Justice Warren. And that's, the natural progression of incorporation, the expansion of the federal government in tandem with the juridicization of American life.
I'm no expert on Greek mythology, but it seems to me that the Olympians engaged in, one form of rampant misbehavior after another. So perhaps there's something to the analogy.
All right. Well, that does conclude our time. So please join me in thanking one more time our panelists.